Hello and welcome. On behalf of CME Outfitters, I would like to welcome and thank you for joining us for episode 3 of this CMEO cast, Tailoring Care, Crafting Individualized and Patient-Centered Narcolepsy Treatment Plans. The podcast series is supported by an educational grant from Avadel Pharmaceuticals. I'm Dr. Erin Marie Morris. I'm the Director of Child Neurology and Pediatric Sleep Medicine at Geisinger in Danville, Pennsylvania. I'm pleased to have my esteemed colleague, Dr. Paul Doug Dromji, to join us today. Paul, please introduce yourself for me.
Yes. Hi. Thank you, Emery. So, yeah, my name is Paul Dagramji. I'm a board-certified family physician in Collegeville, Pennsylvania. So I'm in outpatient medicine. I have a particular interest in sleep disorders and sleep issues. So I'm very attuned to my patients who have sleep problems, including narcolepsy. So I'm very pleased to be able to bring to you information to especially my primary care colleagues about the whole issue of excessive daytime sleepiness and other symptoms that can occur in your patients who come in that are suffering from narcolepsy.
I love so much that you bring up the fact that not only are you a family physician and also the specific call out to other primary cares, but recognizing this in the context of some of the things that we're going to unpack today. We frequently are encountering that individuals who finally get diagnosed with narcolepsy are seeing delays in diagnoses as long as 15 years. And when you look at the literature, many times being referred to 3 to 5 other specialists. Raising the awareness in the bar in primary care practice really can be transformational in the field and really honoring how much primary care physicians really do contribute to the wellness of the patients that we're all interested in optimizing their outcomes for.
Absolutely. I'm also the medical director of a college in the area. Those are obviously the exact ages where you would see a lot of narcolepsy, you know, ages 18 to 23, 24. A lot of patients coming in with excessive daytime sleepiness, what they call tiredness and fatigue and just not feeling well. And some of them actually have narcolepsy. So we have to have our radars up for the possibility that these patients have narcolepsy.
Yes, 100%. So this brings us to what is the goal for today? Our goal for this podcast is to explore the patient's experience and perspective of narcolepsy diagnosis and treatment and how to recognize undertreated symptoms or unmet needs in practice for individualized patient management. I'm really excited because I'm extraordinarily passionate about always elevating the patient voice. And what I think many of our listeners today are going to be also excited about and learn tremendously from, because I believe case-based education really does resonate best with clinicians, is the fact that we are not only going to highlight patients, but we do have a real person who's experiencing this journey, who's going to share with us their personal diagnostic and treatment journey. We also will have a little bit later on some cases for us to review to further define those key points of diagnosis and management that are those clinical pearls that are going to change your clinical practice. So to kick off our podcast today, we're going to first introduce Michael, a patient who has narcolepsy that will be joining us. Michael, please give an introduction, and we're going to definitely want to dig into what your own personal experience has been.
Hi. Thank you very much for the wonderful introduction. My name is Michael. I am 37, married, father of two. I'm also autistic, and I have narcolepsy. And I'm happy to share about my journey getting diagnosed and getting on a treatment plan to address the quality of life issues that go along with that.
Michael, I'm very excited to have you, but I think that what's even more unique about this situation is that Dr. Dagramji is your one of your treating providers. Is that correct?
Absolutely, yes.
And so I think this really does provide this great illustration of what does that care paradigm, what does that dyad look like? Very frequently, I tell people that I'm not their physician or their practitioner. I'm their partner in this journey. And so I'm excited to see how this partnership allows for us to really dig in to what exactly you have experienced and be able to have both sides of that coin. So, Paul, I don't know if you want to kick off some of the questions for Michael for us to kind of really understand. How did you guys come together? And then also, what are some of the things that, Michael, you've identified as what maybe brought you to the attention of a clinician?
Yeah, so Michael has been my patient since 2017, I think. He had some tiredness. He had a couple of other medical problems as well. So that's how things kind of got started, 2017. I think at that time, Michael, if I'm not mistaken, you had been diagnosed with obstructive sleep apnea, but not narcolepsy. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes.
And then you had further sleep studies done after your obstructive sleep apnea was treated well. And the sleep studies that we did, and we actually have a sleep lab in our practice. We have one, we have a sleep specialist, and the sleep lab was able to actually rule in narcolepsy. And at that time when that happened, then we started to discuss the different treatments for narcolepsy to alleviate the main terrible symptom that Michael was having, which was being very drowsy. And Michael, can you tell us, about how drowsy you were and how that affected you in your life?
Absolutely. So imagine just waking up and still feeling tired. Imagine going through your day and at the drop of a hat feeling like you could take a nap, whether you're in a meeting at work, whether you're going out with friends, whether you're trying to spend time with your kids, like the tiredness was always there, like a weight on me.
And I think that this is a really important teaching point. And I love the fact that you've illustrated so importantly that when symptoms don't resolve despite having a diagnosis, so in this particular scenario, excessive daytime sleepiness is plaguing me on a daily basis, that we didn't stop our thought processes and just say, your excessive daytime sleepiness is due to your sleep apnea. Because my understanding, because I had the opportunity to speak with you a little bit earlier, is that you are treated. You're treated with CPAP and the adherent with that, but excessive daytime sleepiness is still present. And so I think the first important clinical pearl for those who are listening is the fact that obstructive sleep apnea is extraordinarily common in central disorders of hypersomnolence. And studies that have evaluated that comorbidity of having narcolepsy and also evaluating obstructive sleep apnea, the statistics vary anywhere from 3 to 18 times more likely than a general population. And on average, we'll say it's probably about 25 to 30% of individuals who have narcolepsy may also have OSA. This is critically important because many times we'll stop the thought process and just name it as excessive daytime sleepiness due to OSA. The reality is that the buck doesn't stop there. There is further diagnostic testing that should be performed in order to ensure you're treating the right condition. Now, when you're describing the excessive daytime sleepiness and the severity that you were experiencing, it sounds like you were just basically in this nonstop wave. Like you're stuck in the ocean and you're kind of trying to paddle to shore, but it's like being stuck in that riptide. It's like every time you make 3 feet forward, you end up being brought 6 feet back. And so, with that stated, how did that manifest? Like, what was the impact that it had on your quality of life, your relationships? You've described that you're married, you have children. How did that look?
So that looked like taking naps in the evening after work. So instead of playing with my kids, like between end of work and dinner, sleeping instead of playing with them, instead of spending time in the evening with them, or on the weekend, just needing multiple naps th throughout the day just to make it through, basically. Even when I didn't have to nap, just not having the feeling like I had the energy to do everything that I wanted with them, that they needed from me, really broke my heart.
Yeah, so it sounds like I'm physically present, but cognitively I'm not. So I'm not missing out. I'm there in body form, but my brain, my personality, my interaction is less than what I would derive pleasure or for the family to derive pleasure. Paul, one of the things I would ask you, because this is such an interesting area that is now currently starting to be explored. Tom Scammell and his group had recently done a publication on this in 2022, talking about the impact in young adults in regards to when you have narcolepsy. How does this impact social relationships? And one of the things I found striking about it, and I think many, especially sleep providers, feel uncomfortable, but you as a family practice, the primary care, I would like to hear your perspective on it, is the impact on relationships and many times the impact on sexual relationships. Because I'm so tired, I'm not participating and falling asleep during, and for some of individuals with narcolepsy with cataplexy, even eliciting cataplexy during this. And I bring this up because of the fact that it is a very, very critical quality of life component that we don't frequently ask. Many times we get embarrassed to ask it, or we're worried about embarrassing the patient. But it's something that is hugely detrimental to relationships and can lead to breakups, divorces, and things like that. So just want to understand, in the primary care, that may be something that they primarily bring up, that I'm having distress in my relationship because I'm just too tired to have romance.
Yeah, actually, it's a very important thing in primary care. We take a lot of importance in primary care to make sure about the quality of life. And quality of life means relationships with children, relationships with spouses, how they're doing at work, how they're feeling overall, whether they're doing their hobbies, activities, etc. And it can impact every single one of them. And we have studies which actually show that quality of life of patients with narcolepsy is very, very low. So to help with our patients with their quality of life, we have to look into not just their daytime sleepiness, but they oftentimes also have comorbidities like depression can occur, obesity can occur, cardiovascular disease can occur. And so they also have to be addressed. With Michael, for example, he does take medication for some of his comorbidities as well. So we have to help them with that to get their quality of life to be the best they possibly can, not just from the excessive daytime sleepiness and not just, let's say, from cataplexy, which doesn't occur in Michael, but that can also occur. So we really have to make sure we address all areas to help our patients have the best quality of life.
Yeah. And I think from what I've heard and you just highlighted is that Michael has narcolepsy type 2. So there isn't the experience of cataplexy. However, some of the things that I think you've also called out that we always need to be mindful of is that in our individuals who we may be managing for narcolepsy type 2, if they do have depression, anxiety, they're on medications for that. We sometimes may be missing out on what other symptoms may be present because those are providing indirectly treatment. Now, Michael, where would you say your treatment journey began? What did you experience? And where would you say you are today?
So I would say it began with trying out, well, first getting the diagnosis. Once we got the obstructive sleep apnea diagnosed and then still realized, no, the sleepiness is still there, then it was, all right, narcolepsy, whack-a-mole in terms of medications. What's going to work? Tried different modafinils and tried some amphetamines, methylphenidate, but it took a while. Once I got on an oxybate, though, that really improved my quality of life. I felt like I was finally waking up rested to a certain degree. And then to help keep me going during the day, taking things like pitolisant, definitely helps.
And I think you've also said that you have solriamfetol as an additional agent. Is that correct?
Yes, I do.
Yeah. And so when I hear your treatment paradigm, and Paul, you probably can reflect on this as well, mm-hmm. of that kind of the introduction of what got offered first and then where you're at now that really has helped in transforming your quality of life and your day to day. It's not uncommon when we look at the guidelines that were put out in 2021, whether you look at the US guidelines or the European guidelines, very frequently we're seeing that the alerting agents are kind of your first line that many people will reach for. So modafinil, armodafinil, solriamfetol, pitolisant, second and third line, your amphetamines and your methylphenidates. And then the reality is that oxybates really do live in this category of also being considered as you should talk about these as a first line therapy. And I think that many times when we are introducing an oxybate, sometimes we see this bias in practice where people are waiting to see how much they fail before being offered an oxybate. And it ends up very frequently, at least in my clinical practice, as being a keystone for many of my patients. Like that's kind of their iron horse. And everything else that I'm adding in helps in really making sure that they're having more predictable day to day. This is not to say that all my patients are on oxybate, absolutely not. But for when we're talking about these, I generally do introduce them from day one. This is what treatments are available. Let's talk about what's going to fit your lifestyle. What are your thoughts about that, Paul?
Yeah, with Michael, he presented with an interesting situation where we had obstructive sleep apnea first and actually some central sleep apnea. So some drowsiness residual, we see that happening in at least a third of people that are treated properly for their obstruction. And he was given actually modafinil, armodafinil as a wake-promoting agent, and that didn't do very well. He actually even was on amphetamine and actually methylphenidate, didn't seem to work. And that's when we started to suspect that there may be something going on. And then further testing suggested that he had the narcolepsy. When that happened, then the oxybates came in, and Michael has done very well with it. But still, he's continued to have some daytime sleepiness. We've been doing Epworth sleepiness scales on him very regularly. And when I say we, I mean the sleep laboratory that we have in our practice. And with the addition of the solriamfetol, as well as the pitolisant, his last ESS was actually 6. So he's done very well with those medications. With the oxybate taken at nighttime and also some daytime medications, as well as making sure that he has a CPAP. A little bit more complicated, or maybe a little bit more backwards, because typically what happens with most people is you rule in the narcolepsy, things don't get as good as you'd like, and then you find out that they might have obstructive sleep apnea. But again, with him, it turned out to be the other way around, but he's doing very well. And that's what we need to do to be persistent and make sure that if there's obstruction, that we take care of that and that we take care of the symptoms of narcolepsy, with oxybate in most cases being a hallmark medication, and then also maybe using some daytime medication that has been effective, as has been with Michael.
Yeah. And I think it's an important call out, because very frequently when I speak all over the country and rural, I'm very, very privileged to get to talk to so many people who are engaged in practice for people who have narcolepsy. I commonly hear the thought that you can't use an oxybate in people who have obstructive sleep apnea. And that's grossly incorrect. There is guidance on you have to be cautious, reevaluate, make sure they don't have further desaturations or worsening. But there's also equal literature out that demonstrate that you can even have the AHI by using an oxybate. And many times it may be a reflection of the change in the ultradian cycling, or how we cycle through the night with that increase in slow wave sleep. Now, Michael, if you were to say, I wish that people knew X about narcolepsy, what would you say that X is? What do you wish that, whether it's general population or clinicians or maybe both, what would you want them to know?
So for the general population, at least for me, I'm not going to fall asleep on you. I'm not going to fall asleep driving. It's that I'm tired. I have this weight on me that I need to push through. That's what I would want the general population to know. For doctors, it's in clinicians, it's like Dr. DeGromji has said, like having a doctor who really listens to the whole of you, understands the different things that are afflicting you, and trying to treat you as a whole person, and not just writing things off, oh, he's just tired, oh, he's just lazy or something. Like, no, it can be a real thing. And in my case, it's, in many others, it's narcolepsy. So.
Thank you so much. I think that those are two very, very impactful and important things for people to hear, because I think you're correct in that there are many times is the media sensationalization from movies and things that you're just going to fall to the ground or fall asleep in your soup. And the reality is that further delays people from seeking out care. So recognizing that that's not going to happen, and also Removing that as something that would be an embarrassment or a stigma for people with narcolepsy. I also very wholeheartedly agree. It's not the thyroid. It's not Lyme disease. It's not mono. People can be sleepy for other reasons. And so making sure that you're continuing to move forward. Paul, I don't know if you have any other things to say before we thank Michael for his significant contribution to this particular educational event.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to make sure that I underscore for primary care providers, there is narcolepsy in your practice. It is there. Think about all your tired patients. And as you said, Anne-Marie, it's not just thyroid and depression and anemia or that sort of stuff. Listen to the patient and see what's going on and try to help them get to where Michael is, which is as normal a life as possible, normal being less drowsy, more alert, more capable, more quality of life, and a good night's sleep. That's what we need to aim for in patients with narcolepsy.
Thank you so much for contributing today, Michael, and I hope that your journey continues to be positive. I think that you're actually highlighting how positive your journey has been, because I think you're going somewhere pretty good tomorrow.
Yes, and I just wanted to thank Dr. Tegramji for all the help he's been, because I do feel like I can live a normal life now, as normal as can be, where my family and I are going to Disney for the first time. And
you can't beat being at the happiest place on earth as the signature of an improved quality of life.
Exactly. I feel like I can be awake when I'm there. I don't have to worry about feeling like I'll need to nap during the day. Like I feel like I can enjoy time with my family, and I'm really appreciative. So thank you.
Enjoy your time there, Michael.
Thank you.
So after getting to hear from Michael and what his journey has looked like, I do think that it is really important for us to highlight even more globally, what is the patient perspective? And what's great is that there is research to be able to highlight this. More and more, we're seeing more literature that is demonstrating the importance of incorporating the patient voice in the lived experience. Because at the end of the day, the reality is that I'm not an expert in the lived experience. I don't think any clinician can claim that. We are not living with this disorder on a day-to-day basis, unless you are a clinician who is. I would like to discuss with you this really great study that was done by the My Narcolepsy team to really kind of highlight what is it that the patient is saying.
So yes, this study was very interesting. Living with narcolepsy, the patient perspective, 110 U.S. members of this narcolepsy team completed a 27-question online survey. And the most troubling symptom was, as you would expect, excessive daytime sleepiness, drowsiness, and tiredness, as patients will sometimes call it, or fatigue. But again, it's excessive daytime sleepiness. It is that symptom that you get for a normal person right before you're going to go off to sleep. Imagine feeling that way all the time. That's excessive daytime sleepiness. They also noticed fatigue, daytime concentration problems. Yes, if you're tired, sleepy like that, you can't concentrate very well. Your memory isn't going to be good. So these were all the symptoms that they had. And it's very important for us to know when patients come in talking to us about tiredness, see if it's a sleepiness thing. Is it a drowsiness thing? And it's very important to tease out that, you know, when they're saying they're tired, what it is that they're saying. And, you know, patients' desired treatment endpoints. I'm so tired of being tired. Restfulness is non-existent. Depression is growing over time. I hope to one day, a small degree, to reclaim my life and identity. Another quote, narcolepsy takes the control I have over my own wakefulness away. I want to be able to wake up and stay awake, then go to bed at night as expected. I have no routine without treatment. I'm never fully asleep or awake. I'm a body on autopilot, keeping in mind that narcolepsy is a 24/7 problem. It's not just being tired or sleepy during the day. It's also terrible sleep. People with narcolepsy have a very bad night's sleep because of what's going on. And again, keep in mind, by the way, folks, what's this? In most cases, it's damage to the orexin nucleus that's going on in the brain that's causing a disruption of not just the daytime wakefulness, but also the nighttime sleep. So this is a really compelling data that shows that we need to know about tiredness in our patients.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that I would take from this, or actually there's several things, is number one, as exciting and interesting as this is, it's not novel. This is something that is replicated across multiple studies that incorporate the patient voice. And the question that always comes to the forefront is, are these all manifestations of inadequate sleepiness? Is the fatigue, the difficulty concentrating, the memory problems, or are these actually co-occurring when you optimally treat the excessive daytime sleepiness? Are you still seeing fatigue? Are you still seeing difficulty concentrating? Are you still seeing memory problems? And sometimes you do, which again is giving us further endpoints that we need to consider. When we reflect on studies like the Nexus registry data, we see that the number one reason, yes, was excessive daytime sleepiness, but other reasons that people may come and complain are, I'm having difficulties at school. I'm having difficulties at work. And sometimes it's even things that are within those other REM dissociative, recurrent nightmare disorder, REM behavior disorder. Finally, it's important to recognize that interventions that are strongly recommended by the American Academy of Sleep Medicine are underutilized in practice. So the clinical guidelines in 2021, very frequently, we even heard this from Michael, we're going straight to modafinil, and then we're going to second and third line agents. And we're skipping over options that may be actually treating the whole patient. I think, unfortunately, some of this gets reinforced by the fact that when we look at what the FDA approves drugs for, it's never for narcolepsy. It's excessive daytime sleepiness or cataplexy, recognizing that the burden of this disorder is a 24/7 disorder, and it's not just making me more awake. So let's look at a patient. So Dr. Doug Ramji, will you go ahead and introduce our first clinical case?
Okay, here we go. Case number one, Lamar. So Lamar is an 18-year-old male who is presenting to you, primary care provider, after noticing a series of new unusual symptoms in the last 4 months. He's constantly sleepy and feeling like he's in a fog. He's briefly forgetting what he had just been doing or saying to his partner. He's had some weight gain. Remember that, folks, with narcolepsy, these people have a tendency to gain weight. There's a strange sensation and weakness after getting emotional. That's, again, the whole cataplexy thing, right? Worsening depression and anxiety symptoms, mood problems are more likely to occur. They're more comorbid with narcolepsy. Lamar has a past medical history of depression and anxiety diagnosed 5 years ago. He has one cup of coffee before lunch per day and two in the afternoon. He's never used alcohol, tobacco, or other smoking, vaping products. His current medications include bupropion, extended release, 300 milligrams once a day in the morning, and sertraline, 100 milligrams once a day in the evening. So, this is a very interesting case, and I think that I need to ask you, you know, do you have any other questions or any other concerns that you have of Lamar?
Yeah, I mean, when I look at this, there's a couple of things that stand out to me is that many times I can see where the symptoms he's describing get repackaged into the diagnosis he already has. So depression and anxiety. So is he having this forgetfulness, this weight gain, this kind of feeling of sleepiness because he's more depressed, he's more detached, he's not able to concentrate because he has less interest, recognizing that attention is necessary for me to recall. And so very frequently we see that these medications start to get adjusted more. Now, others would say, well, is he so sleepy that he only needs this one cup of coffee in a day? Many times we're seeing that everyone's using tons of coffee. And when I look at his medication, something like bupropion, which is a selective norepinephrine reuptake inhibitor, as well as a dopamine reuptake inhibitor, is similar in mechanism to drugs we use to treat excessive daytime sleepiness, like solriamfetol. And so sometimes we may be seeing that between the sertraline and bupropion, we're modifying the severity of the symptoms, which may lead us to these delays in diagnoses. So I really would want to understand, before these medications, what were you like? With these medications, do you see that these symptoms have gotten better or worse with adjustments in them? And that may actually help us. And you're correct about the weight gain. For myself, when I see my kiddos who end up being diagnosed with narcolepsy, very frequently I can look at their growth chart in my electronic health record and say, did the onset of symptoms start at X year? And the family sometimes look at me like I'm a magician, but it's because their percentile on the growth chart had jumped by 2-3-fold.
Yeah.
So what's some more
any other questions that you would want to ask of Lamar, Dr. Morris?
Well, I would definitely want to get some more of the information in regards to whether he has any prior history of any other sleep issues, Has his sleep changed? I would want to dig into more of the emotion triggering these events and really trying to characterize what is the weakness he's experiencing, what is the distribution. Most people, when they think about cataplexy, think about it as a complete cataplexy where we have collapsed to the ground. But what is much more common is partial or focal cataplexies, where it might just be a head drop, knees buckling, my mouth falling open, and really understanding what does that symptom spectrum look like. You also would want to understand what is this impact? How is he qualifying the change in his quality of life or changes that he's seeing on a day-to-day basis based on his excessive daytime sleepiness?
Yeah, and I think that we would conduct an ESS on these patients. I know in my practice, in my electronic medical records, there is an ESS that's built in. So all I got to do is choose between, 0, 1, 2, 3, and it'll give me the addition number. Keep in mind that a number above 10 is abnormal. We also want to look at, I guess, sleep hygiene practices, don't you think?
So in anyone, I think that the typical approach of anyone with sleepiness is understanding a full comprehensive sleep history. What is their sleep hygiene, but also the timing that they're going to sleep, waking up, how many nocturnal awakenings, are there REM dissociative features, and then really characterizing also the napping frequency if it's present.
All right. So, and also, by the way, I guess, with me, with a lot of my patients, they come in with a lot of over the counter, not medications, but also supplements, this, that, whatever. Keep in mind, folks, that some of them can also interfere with sleep or sleepiness. Going on with this case, let me give you some more additional information about Lamar. Lamar's family history does not include any sleep disorders, that he's aware of. Now, his mother has type 2 diabetes. His father was diagnosed with depression, who takes medications for high cholesterol. Lamar has endured some past daytime sleepiness, including in middle school, where he would accidentally nap during a class or on a bus on the way home. He says that he goes to bed at around 11:30 p.m., usually has to get up by 8 a.m., but has trouble going. But has trouble, I'm sorry, trouble doing so. And he sleeps about 13 hours per night on most weekends. So a little bit different on weekdays versus weekends, which, by the way, is very common amongst teenagers. He wakes up multiple times throughout the night as related to the strange sensations observed following emotion. His friend recently told him something funny while he was walking to class, and his knees buckled, resulting in a fall. This typically would last about 20 seconds or so. The only OTC medication Lamar says that he uses occasionally is caffeine supplement and acetaminophen as needed. No other medication changes have been made. So you have Lamar complete the ESS. And look at this, it's 19. The maximum is 24. He has 9. This guy is really, really sleepy. Don't you think, Dr. Morris?
Yeah, so I think that there's a lot of things that stand out here. And so when we're looking at his sleep history, number one, inappropriate napping during school. And so very frequently I'll hear my teenagers say, well, I don't nap because I'm tired. I nap when I'm bored. And so I just want to make sure that people hear me say this. Boredom doesn't make you fall asleep. Sleepiness makes you fall asleep. And so when you're put in a position that is non-activating, the sleepiness emerges. It basically makes you fall asleep. Now, when you're looking at his total sleep times, the first thing that people would say is, oh, it has to be those early school start times. But he's saying that he can wake up at 8 a.m. or that he has the ability to wake up, not that he is able to. And when looking at that, he's getting about 8 hours to 8.5 hours of sleep a night. And so with that stated, a typical teenager should be getting 8 to 10 hours. However, on most nights, on the weekends, he wants to get 13 hours. So really having this elongation of sleep time, which sometimes you can see in a variety of central disorders of hypersomnolence. He also describes disturbed nocturnal sleep, and these sensations are really very concerning for features of narcolepsy. And in fact, I would say to you that with his history of chronic sleepiness greater than 3 months and a clinical depiction of cataplexy that is pretty certain, with the DSM-5, you would be able to diagnose him. Now, with that stated, most people will say, I need to use, and insurances as well, will say that you need to use the International Classifications of Sleep Disorders, Edition 3, and the most recent text revision. They remove the duration of sleepiness for narcolepsy type 1, but typically are still including objective data that shows that there is severe sleepiness, such as on the MSLT. And so with this very severe degree of sleepiness, an Epworth of a 19, typically we say greater than 16 is consistent with severe sleepiness. And this pattern of symptom profile makes me very concerned for narcolepsy type 1. Unfortunately, with the weight gain and the sleepiness, many physicians may stop at saying he needs to be seen for OSA, for sleep apnea. However, what I would also say is pediatric patients, even though he's 18 now, pediatric patients are typically less likely to manifest as a sleep apnea with sleepiness phenotype. They're more likely to be kind of a ADHD, either hyperactive, inattentive type phenotype or otherwise, but they're less likely to be that severe sleepiness. But for me, this is a kiddo or young adult who I would definitely want to be seen by sleep medicine and have further evaluation with a polysomnography, an in-lab polysomnography with next day multiple sleep latency test.
Yeah, again, to summarize, you know, for my primary care colleagues, think about your patients who are coming in that are in the pediatric age group or young adult group who are tired. Understand what that tiredness means, okay? Is it a sleepiness? Is it a drowsiness? They may feel rested after waking up, after a nap, but there's persistent sleepiness throughout the day, where, as we've given an example, they fall asleep in class. There's an urge to sleep and falling asleep unwillingly during an activity like watching TV or driving. They sit down to watch TV, they sleep. Sleep problems, that's the second thing. Uneven or disrupted sleep, waking up throughout the night, okay? So sleepiness, sleep problems, and finally, cataplexy, which is type 1 narcolepsy versus the type 2, which our earlier patient had type 2. He did not have narcolepsy. So these are the things that you need to ask of your patient, keeping in mind that, look, patients with type 1 narcolepsy experience an average diagnostic delay of 15 years. We have to have our eyes and ears open. All right, so let's go back to our case 1. Lamar's sleep study just revealed a total sleep time of 453 minutes. On the polysomnogram, with no significant sleep disorder, breathing, or other disturbances found. His sleep latency on the average was 3.8 minutes, and his SORAM was present in 2 out of the 4 naps on the MSLT. So again, now I should back off and say this, you know, as a primary care provider, if you suspect somebody is having narcolepsy, you can just send them to the sleep specialist and let them take care of it from there. Or in other instances, if you want, you can order a polysomnogram followed by a daytime study if you want to. And if you do that and you get the study, you then have to act on it. So in this case, what is Lamar's most likely diagnosis? Obviously, you know, we're looking at him having narcolepsy, and then we have to think about the possibility of sleep medication. Typically, in primary care, this is going to be up to the sleep specialist like you, Anne-Marie. So what would you do at this point?
Yeah, so prior to acknowledging the treatment piece, one of the things I do want to just comment on is very frequently I get asked the question, if a patient is like Lamar and they were on bupropion and sertraline and they can't get off them, can he still do the testing? And what I would say is that let's say you had this result and he was still on the medication, this makes it even more positive because generally those medications are REM suppressing. However, you would want to make sure that if you can get them off, you're getting them off that medication about 2 weeks or 5 half-lives before, therefore, this test so that you're not contributing to false testing. My medication options that I would want to consider would really be based on what is most problematic for the patient. So when looking again at the symptom spectrum that he's experiencing, he has this very severe excessive daytime sleepiness that really is imposing on all of his areas of life. He's having this long duration of sleep time. And then he also is having features of cataplexy. Now, even though you can look at the treatment options and say you have alerting agents, you have oxybates, you have your traditional stimulants, the question I would want to pose to him is saying, would you like to treat both your excessive daytime sleepiness and cataplexy? Because I do believe that's the symptom you're describing.
The next thing that we want to talk about is our treatment goals in narcolepsy. We kind of discussed this with our case presentation, Michael, when he was talking to us earlier, which was actually to improve his quality of life. To improve quality of life, we need to reduce the excessive daytime sleepiness and make them as little tired as possible. And there are so many options. We've already talked about not just daytime medications like modafinil, armodafinil, solriamfetol and pitolisant, as well as amphetamines, which are all indicated for the daytime sleepiness of narcolepsy, but also nighttime medications like oxybate, and there are several different formulations of that. We also want to control cataplexy, and some of the medications can help do that, including daytime pitolisant, but also as well the nighttime oxybates, controlling nightmares, hallucinations. Now, we didn't even discuss this yet, but patients can get sleep paralysis and hypnagogic hallucinations and hypnopompic hallucinations, and we want to try to reduce these in our patients, and oxybates can help do that. Improve psychological function and quality of life. Again, keeping in mind that a lot of these patients are disturbed by their symptoms, and they may actually develop frank major depressive disorder, which might require treatment as well. We want to improve safety. We want to tell our patients that when they're driving, we can't have them be drowsy. So do everything you can to get them as least drowsy as possible, and try to actually document that by trying to get an Epworth sleepiness scale that's 10 or less. And then finally, optimizing the risk-benefit of pharmacotherapies. Your patients need to know how to take these medications properly, what are some of the side effects, what they need to know, how to store them properly. And I think that one of the things that's recently and interestingly come out is the oxybates can be twice a day at night, or they can even be once a day. Can you comment on some of these medications again, Dr. Morse?
Yeah, so when we're looking at FDA-approved treatments for narcolepsy, it's important that when you're considering options, that you're considering not only what they're indicated for, also how they work, their mechanisms, and then what is the burden on the patient of how to be able to take them. We've highlighted earlier that it's not uncommon that patients who have narcolepsy, that this isn't the only disorder that they're juggling medications around. And so we want to also then look at those interactions, impact on perhaps hormonal therapies like oral contraceptive, as well as what may be the risk in pregnancy, recognizing that it's not uncommon for women to be afflicted by these conditions. So when we look at these medications, we have modafinil, armodafinil. Those are both dopamine reuptake inhibitors and have a similarity to your amphetamines and methylphenidates. Your amphetamines and methylphenidates, they not only have this effect on dopamine and potentially some norepinephrine and serotonin, but they're also sympathomimetics. What does that mean? They're activating for your sympathetic nervous system. That's going to make you sweat. It's going to make you heart rate go up, your blood pressure go up. And so therefore, we're frequently using those more as second and third line therapies. Those are kind of our add-ons. They generally are not our primary treatment therapies. With modafinil, armodafinil, we then also have a newer agent, solriamfetol, which is also a dopamine reuptake inhibitor, but also has a norepinephrine reuptake inhibitor. The studies in evaluating that have demonstrated that it's very helpful in excessive daytime sleepiness in narcolepsy, but also perhaps that you may have a little bit of a better profile in regards to those blood pressure changes. You then have pitolisant, which is your only non-controlled substance, which is a unique mechanism of action, your histamine antagonist, inverse agonist. This is a medication you're taking once daily, and you can go from 8.9 to 35.6 milligrams. And it's even been looked at in Europe, evaluating it in not only adults, but potentially in children. It does not have an indication in children in the U.S. And then finally, your oxybate medications. So you have sodium oxybate, which we have over 20 years experience with twice nightly sodium oxybate, clearly demonstrating significant benefit for patients who have narcolepsy, as well as a tremendous safety profile. We then see the introduction in around 2018 of lower sodium oxybate, which is composed of calcium, magnesium, potassium, and sodium oxybate. These are both your twice nightly oxybates. And now the new kid on the block is your once nightly sodium oxybate. This is removing that forced awakening in the middle of the night to allow for a patient to be able to take it just once at bedtime. Now, it is important to call out that for your oxybates, they are indicated for excessive daytime sleepiness and cataplexy. With your sodium and low sodium oxybates, they have an indication in adult and pediatrics FDA indication. Once nightly sodium oxybate does not yet have that, but spoiler alert, as a practicing clinician, I do use once nightly sodium oxybate in my pediatric patients, and insurances will approve it. And what I will tell you is that for some of these patients, it has been life-changing for the entire family because of the fact that it wasn't just the child or the teenager who had to wake up. It was the entire family, the siblings, everyone, because the alarms, the screaming, the commotion, everything else that would go on. And so really recognizing that none of these medications are a one-size-fits-all. It really is the approach of how do we treat more patients to their care needs and getting there every day to be much more predictable rather than feeling like I constantly have to make choices on what we do.
Excellent. Thank you very much. That's a beautiful analysis of all the medications that you can choose from. Let's go on to another case. It's going to be our final case. Riley is a 34-year-old young lady, a woman who presents to the Sleep Disorder Center for ongoing management of her type 1 narcolepsy. She reports increased anxiety and weight loss since her last appointment and is concerned about the grogginess at her new job. Her past medical history includes, of course, type 1 narcolepsy, but also some dyslipidemia. Her current medications include extended release amphetamine, dextroamphetamine salts at 20 milligrams twice daily, sodium oxybate 3.75 milligrams twice nightly with a 7.5 milligram total dose, rosuvastatin 20 milligrams once a day. Now, her 30 milligram dose of amphetamine, dextroamphetamine, XR once daily in the morning was not adequately controlling her symptoms per her last appointment 2 months ago and was increased to the dosage above. The sodium oxybate is a new addition added to and titrated up to the current dosage and increased symptoms of cataplexy 6 months ago. So here's the thing. What should we consider with Riley's medication regimen? Could her weight loss and increased anxiety be related to the increased stimulant dose? Because she says, my stimulant is a morning med with breakfast and cholesterol medication is with dinner. I rarely forget those. I usually take the oxybate twice, once at bedtime. Then I set an alarm for 3 hours later for the second dose. Sometimes lately, I don't take the second dose, which is obviously a problem because I go to bed too late for getting up at 5 a.m. I have this different sleep schedule with my new job and don't get like I feel like getting up again. If it ends up being 2 a.m., by the time I take the second dose, I feel really groggy. Once I fell in the morning when I was tired like this and had to call in for work. So I'm having trouble taking that at this point. So Dr. Morse, what kind of thoughts come to mind about what we can do to help Riley?
Yeah, so I think that there's several options to consider. So first and foremost is the anxiety and weight loss related to the amphetamine. That's a distinct possibility. One of the things that we do see across most of the treatment options is weight loss. And what's interesting is sometimes that's a welcome side effect. And in fact, when looking at the oxybates, we sometimes even say, could this be a part of the responder profile that someone who's really responding to an oxybate that we may see some weight loss. Now, with that stated, we don't want anxiety for anyone. And we do see that can very commonly occur because of that sympathomimetic effect, that activating sympathetic nervous system. So first and foremost, we can consider some other options for her daytime meds. Thinking about something like the pitolisant, that could get at her excessive daytime sleepiness and potentially help with the cataplexy as well. Solriamfetol, this is for myself in my own clinical practice, a medication I do reach for more commonly in my women patients because it doesn't interact with hormonal therapies if they're on hormonal therapies. And the animal data is relatively favorable in regards to pregnancy, although we don't have human data to confirm that. Now, with that stated, we then would have to go through these considerations as to are those the things that she wants to do for her daytime meds. Now, when I'm looking at her nighttime meds and I'm saying that she's on a twice nightly oxybate, and there's a high degree of variability, even potentially a concern of safety in taking those second doses and then doing that midnight math, right? We hear our patients do it all the time. I overset my alarm, then I woke up, I looked at the clock, I had to figure out how many hours do I have. The question becomes, do we consider another option? So one thing that people would say is, we're looking at her cardiovascular risk profile. Do I need to consider sodium? She's otherwise a healthy individual. So some may think about lower sodium oxybate. Challenge with that is we're still not getting to the point of she still may miss that second dose. There is a slight difference in pharmacokinetics between sodium oxybate and low sodium oxybate. So even a dose to dose, it is a lower exposure of oxybate. So maybe she might be able to wake up for that second dose. The second is saying, why worry about the second dose? Maybe perhaps this is the opportunity to introduce her to something like a once nightly sodium oxybate. Her total dosing is 7.5 grams. And so the question becomes, do I transition her directly to a 7.5 gram or do I start her off at something lower? Why would I consider that? Because she's telling me she's not consistent in taking that second dose. And so perhaps I really want to quantify first how frequently she's actually missing that second dose, because switching her 7.5 to 7.5 directly may actually make her feel like it's too much. So if she's telling me that, in 7 nights a week, 3 to 4 nights a week, I'm missing a dose. I may introduce 6 grams to start with a quick titration up to the 7.5 in a week, because that likely will be where she will benefit. But really trying to understand what might be the best opportunity for her. And for me, based on what she's describing, it probably would be trying to transition her to a once nightly sodium oxybate where I may see a more consistent degree of benefit. And then evaluating whether or not we can reduce that Adderall XR or remove it and transition it to something like solriamfetol or pitolisant.
Okay. And can you tell us about some of the pharmacology in patients with narcolepsy? It can be sometimes confusing.
So when we're looking at the pharmacology in patients who have narcolepsy, it is important to recognizing when we had reviewed the different types of medications that there are different mechanisms of how the drugs work in individuals. So some of them working on the dopamine system, some of them working on histamine. And with the oxybate, it's not completely clear. However, there is some strong data that demonstrates that it likely works on the GABA-B receptors. There also are specific receptors in the brain that are for GHB specifically. And between those, they're probably also modifying some of the expression of dopamine, serotonin, and norepinephrine. Now, with that stated, polypharmacy typically is very common in patients with narcolepsy because of the multiple symptoms. And I don't know about you, Paul, but I do not have any 2 days in my week that look exactly the same. So having the expectation that the drugs that I'm going to give, you're going to take the same exact way every single day and every day is going to look the same, is really just, it's absurd. And so it's absurd for us as medical clinicians. It's also absurd for the increasing number of insurances who have stated that polypharmacy is not used in narcolepsy, because my goal is to decrease vulnerability and increase predictability day to day. And so it really needs to be tailored to what the patient's needs and preferences are, their lifestyle and whatever other substances they may use, severity of sleepiness, their comorbidities, cardiovascular risk. Are they on any hormonal therapies? And then also, what is the convenience? We recognize if you look at any treatment research, when you simplify the regimen, you make it more predictable, less easy to forget or miss. You increase the adherence. When adherence is improved, symptom outcomes are improved. This isn't rocket science. This is really very common and expected, repeated across organ systems. And so really that tends to be my goal of really trying to understand how to best optimize all these in individuals and really recognizing this is not a sprint, it's a marathon. And so we're on this journey together, and what's working today may need to be adjusted over time. So Dr. Dagramji, I would really like you to just kind of help for us thinking about family medicine physicians, primary carers, other healthcare partners, identifying narcolepsy and therefore avoiding some of the common diagnostic and treatment delays, and really kind of highlighting the critical role, again, that the primary care provider has in the ongoing management of narcolepsy.
Yeah, I think that the first and foremost thing that I've mentioned on several different occasions now is that we in primary care need to be alert to patients who are drowsy, excessive daytime sleepiness, falling asleep in class, coming home from school and falling asleep on the couch, sleeping as opposed to doing, let's say, after school sports or their studies. So that's a very important thing to consider with our patients. Or if they're college age students, they're falling asleep in class or falling asleep at the wheel while driving, which actually happened to one of my patients. It was a pretty serious situation. Or maybe even older, in their mid 20s or so, just feeling very tired and sleepy. If a patient comes in saying they're tired and sleepy, think about the possibility of narcolepsy, not just that they have iron deficiency or thyroid deficiency or they're depressed or that sort of stuff. Do an Epworth sleepiness scale, make sure that they're sleeping properly, and if at all they're possible, and if you can actually rule in the symptom of narcolepsy, then you got to send them off for sleep testing. Either order the sleep test yourself or send them to a sleep laboratory that will look for the possibility of narcolepsy occurring. And when they do rule in the diagnosis, make sure you're a partner in the care of that patient, because not only do you need to know that they're adherent with their medications and that they are following through with the sleep specialist, but also think about their comorbidities. Weight gain, depression, obstructive sleep apnea, Some of these things can occur in a higher rate than these patients with narcolepsy. So see your patients often, much more often, when they have narcolepsy and they've ruled in. We can be an excellent partner with our patients as well as our sleep specialist in helping our patients for the best quality of life that they can with their narcolepsy.
Yeah, and I very much advocate, especially being a part of a large comprehensive healthcare system, to reinforce the medical home. The relationship that a primary care has does not get replicated with any specialist. It is just such a more intimate and comprehensive relationship. And really, I entrust my primary care partners to be able to help informing me of when there are other medical things that may be at play, as well as being that integration of all the other specialists that may be involved, whether it's psychology, cardiology, ENT, psychiatry, and really being able to help the patient have the best journey with as little barriers as possible. So in summary, today we have some specific goals that you can take away into practice from this podcast. These are your SMART goals: specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and timely. Consider narcolepsy. I'm going to say it one more time. Consider narcolepsy if characteristic or unusual symptoms of sleepiness appear, especially in childhood or adolescence, as narcolepsy is frequently misdiagnosed or just missed, and the diagnosis is delayed. Recognize unmet needs and poorly managed symptoms in patients with narcolepsy, and consider various pharmacotherapies that sometimes you have to combine that can be included in treatment plans for these patients. Thank you for this excellent discussion today, Paul. You have brought into the conversation such really pivotal information, especially for our primary care providers. Two other podcast episodes on this series, in which we more specifically discuss diagnosis and treatment, are also available. Make sure you don't miss out on those. All three narcolepsy podcast episodes and a wide variety of education and resources are available on the CME Outfitters Sleep Disorders Education Hub for both healthcare providers and patients.